cayó un gavilán. Los pollitos comentaron que si se cayó solito o los vientos lo tumbaron. Todos mis animalitos con el ruido se espantaron.
Welcome back. I'm Ian Masters, and this is Background Briefing. And I'm now joined by Tim Johnson, who is the Mexico City Bureau Chief for McClatchy Newspapers. He worked for 14 years for the Miami Herald, covering U.S. policy towards Latin America, serving as a foreign correspondent for the Herald through most of the 1990s in Central America and the Andean region. Between 2003 and 2009, Tim Johnson was the Beijing Bureau Chief for Knight Ridder and McClatchy, with responsibility for China and Taiwan. He's the author of the new book, Tragedy in Crimson, How the Dalai Lama Conquered the World but Lost the Battle with China. Welcome to Background Briefing, Tim Johnson.
Thank you very much, Ian.
There were substantial demonstrations throughout Mexico yesterday, prompted by the murder last week of the son of a very prominent poet. This 25-year-old son was killed along with five others, 24-year-old Juan Francisco Cecilia, and his father, Javier Cecilia, seems to have galvanized the nation in a protest. He actually met with the President Calderon before leading this protest and before condemning the Mexican government for basically, we're sick of you politicians. This is a badly planned, badly executed, and badly led war. You have put the country into a state of emergency. So those are fighting words.
It was, and it was his ability to articulate this frustration that led to these marches in 33 cities across Mexico. This was a pretty widespread outpouring of unhappiness with the situation, in a sense that President Calderon's strategy is not bringing results that people want.
And on top of that, of course, there was the macabre discovery of 59 bodies in mass graves in the northern state of Tamaulipas, not far from a ranch where 72 Central and South Americans were executed late last year. So there is a sort of an incredible, a level of depravity that keeps catching you by surprise in this drug war in Mexico, which has claimed 37,000 lives. Do you feel that way,
certainly,
Tim?
Certainly, you know, having a mass grave, they haven't given an official count yet of how many bodies are in there, but they say there are at least 59. Now, unlike the incident last August, some of these victims are Mexicans, and they may have been taken off public buses that were in that area. San Fernando is the name of the nearest city. And so it doesn't appear that these are all migrants, which really also is a tremendous abuse. Amnesty International came out this morning with a statement, you know, exhorting Mexicans to take this most seriously in terms of determining who did this and who the victims are.
Again, I'm speaking with Tim Johnson, who is the Mexico City Bureau Chief for McClatchy Newspapers in Mexico City. What is the day after then? One of the things that I had heard from some specialists I'd spoken to earlier on Mexico about the drug war is that there is perhaps a cynical strategy here to essentially for the government to side with one drug lord, meaning El Chapo Guzman, let him wipe out everybody else, and then that's the only way they'll get peace. Have you heard anything to that effect?
Certainly, it's a widely held wish and belief among Mexicans who are frustrated with the violence. There was a recent poll, I believe about 2 weeks ago, that said 6 out of 10 Mexicans feel that Calderon's strategy has not worked. And in fact, the same number think he's actually losing control of the country. So that demonstrates to a certain point the level, the sort of bleak atmosphere among many Mexicans. Now, how they respond to that takes several different forms. One hears a lot of Mexicans say the strategy is not working, the government needs to negotiate with the drug trafficking organizations and basically reach some sort of accommodation. And that, you know, this is what would have happened under the institutional revolutionary party that governed Mexico for more than seven decades until the year 2000. There was really a tacit understanding with these drug organizations that, you know, one group would have control of a certain drug smuggling corridor and another group would have another one. But it really involves tremendous levels of corruption. And the real question is, you know, how you could actually organize such a thing. You know, my own personal view is sort of like how one would have gone about trying to, negotiate with Al Capone. It's a really difficult strategy, and I don't think that Mexicans have necessarily thought this out, except it just shows a real deep frustration.
Well, arguably, though, Tim Johnson, this war on drugs that has been going on for decades and has cost billions of dollars, a lot of analysts here in the United States have basically declared it dead on arrival and deeply dysfunctional. And the Mexicans' complaint largely is that you guys are the market. It's you Americans who consume these drugs, and we're bearing the brunt of your habit. You know, we've lost 37,000 of our citizens because of your drug habit. And this gets to the inevitable question of legalization is one of the words used, and medicalization may be an alternative. But a new strategy, just, you know, not continuing with Einstein's definition of insanity, keep doing the same thing and expecting a different outcome. Mm-hmm. My understanding is every time the Mexican government has flirted with the idea of some kind of legalization, the United States has come down on them.
Well, the legalization trend in the public opinion is certainly moving in the direction of saying this is something that needs to be studied. You know, every month or two, one has new intellectuals and public sort of pundits come out in favor of this, including the former president Vicente Fox, is one of the most prominent advocates of a legalization strategy. It's very difficult in this political environment, though, to make headway on something like that without doing it in coordination with other countries, unless one is determined to sabotage a relationship with the U.S. That's because Washington is so dead set against it. It's a really a difficult thing. But in the marches yesterday, legalization was one of the subjects that one could read on the banners of people doing the marching. So, you know, a lot of people believe that that is, you know, definitely something that Mexicans should consider.
But in terms of the banners of the thousands of people who marched in protest, galvanized by this popular poet and journalist whose son was murdered in Cuernavaca, which is a very safe place where young Mexicans go to get married and have honeymoons, etc. I'm interested to get a sense of the cross-section of those who demonstrated, because it seems to me that if you've got this frustration with the public, sick of this, feel that the government's not pursuing the right strategy in this war and they just want it over with, doesn't that open up an opportunity for the cartels, who have enormous resources at any rate, to basically wear the authorities down and just say, you know, the only way out of this is a truce?
Well, I would say several things. First, on the composition of those who come out, it's very varied. You had older people here in Mexico City. You had lots of young people. The banners, the most consistent banner was the slogan that's been in use for a couple of months now, which it basically in Spanish would be "No más sangre," no more blood. So that kind of captures the mood that people are just tired of just a horrendous string of atrocities that are occurring, either by violence between the drug trafficking organizations or by the state battling the cartels or the cartels battling back. I must say, though, that I just arrived yesterday from a trip to Central America where I was also reporting on what I consider to be a really an untold story of very weak governments succumbing to drug trafficking organizations down there, which we could touch on in a minute if you wanted. But I was expecting actually more people to turn out at these marches than did. The estimate is that there were about 20,000 here in Mexico City. But given the levels of violence and given the articulateness of this poet's Javier Cecilia, I thought that actually more people would turn out. And it puzzles me a bit why there isn't a larger mass movement in Mexico to say enough.
Well, that could translate, though, Tim Johnson, again, Mexico City Bureau Chief for the McClatchy newspapers. We're talking to Tim in Mexico City. Isn't it possible that the PRI party could come back and capitalize on this? You know, when the PRI were in, they made a kind of cozy deal with the drug cartels, and there wasn't any violence, but there was deep corruption. Calderon has tried to clean up Dodge, and it's not working. And the cartels are basically turning up the heat, and the blood is flowing because they're that ruthless.
Yeah. Well, here's what I would suggest about the PRI strategy. You know, we have presidential elections next year, but the PRI is not focusing on the violence and the drug counter-drug strategy as its linchpin for this campaign. They're focusing on the economy, and so that gives you an idea that, you know, while it's horrendous, and as we read about it as foreigners, it seems that the levels of violence have really become just, almost incomprehensibly high. A lot of Mexicans are far more concerned about joblessness and, an economy that has failed to sort of pick up and create better opportunities for people. That is a predominant concern, despite this terrible drug violence situation.
And, of course, the recession here in the United States has dried up that safety valve that Mexico's always had of exporting its unemployed to the United States. And, of course, the United States has made it much more difficult to make these crossings, witness where you've got also people coming up from Central and South America as well, who are preyed upon in Mexico. So the whole thing is really quite tragic. But let's turn to Central America, where you just returned from, Tim Johnson, because a while back I spoke with the former vice president of Costa Rica, who said, and it surprised me what he said, but he said, you know, the government of Guatemala is a narco government. Guatemala is lost to the cartels. Honduras is under threat, and so is El Salvador, where the president recently visited. My understanding is that what's happened here is that Plan Colombia in Colombia drove the cartels out of Colombia into Mexico, and Plan Merida in Mexico is now driving them into more hospitable places in Central America.
That's absolutely correct. It's squeezing the balloon at both ends, and so the trafficking organizations have moved heavily into the northern part of Guatemala, what's known as the Petén. I was there last October, and I can tell you that there are parts of it that are virtually a no man's land. There's areas in one national park that are virtually a boneyard for discarded airplanes by the drug traffickers. I was just in Honduras, and for the first time ever, they have discovered a cocaine processing laboratory in Honduras. It's never been found outside of the Andean region. So the drug cartels are actually bringing up semi-processed coca paste into Honduras to process into actual refined cocaine in Honduras. It has never happened. So, you know, it's another sign that the drug organizations are really finding a better venue for their activities in places like Honduras. You know, there are parts of Honduras also where they're getting five or six tracings of aircraft coming in from Colombia and Venezuela of unidentified aircraft every day. And these are, you know, routinely drug flights. So I spoke with a security minister in Honduras, and he told me that that there are 10 members of Congress that are have open investigations for links to drug organizations. So, another man told me he thought the number more accurately would be 16. So more than a 10% of the Congress is believed to have direct links to the drug industry. It's a pretty dramatic situation.
And Tim Johnson, in terms of Guatemala having been taken over by criminals and Honduras being in the process of being taken over by criminals, my understanding is also that Venezuela, led by Hugo Chavez, who has regional ambitions and a strong political agenda, that he's nevertheless presiding over a totally dysfunctional country with one of the highest crime rates in the world. And basically the drug traffickers have a free rein there.
Well, I think that the drug traffickers have been able to strike up alliances with sectors of the Venezuelan military. And so You know, whether I don't think Chavez has necessarily been complicit, but the military has been able to foster some of these networks, and so a lot of the drug the planes that come out of Colombia instead fly west into Venezuela, then they fly north either towards the Caribbean or towards Honduras and Mexico, and that's because the Colombians have been very effective at closing down what they call the air bridge. They've just, shut down the skies with the help of the U.S., of course. And that's, that's what's caused a number of the changes in drug smuggling practices. You know, a lot of the Colombians organizations are now using these submarines. First, there was semi-submersible vessels that would bring loads of cocaine up, but now they have full-fledged 100-foot submarines that can dive as low as, sort of 24, 25 feet underwater, and the Colombians don't have the sonar equipment to really detect these vessels. So
sure, they make them out of fiberglass too, so that
they make them out of fiberglass, right. And they can carry, a number of tons, 8-10 tons of cocaine, and they can go all the way up as far as San Diego with these things, and turn around and go back. And so it's this has made a very large new challenge for interdiction.
Well, Tim Johnson, I'm afraid we've run out of time here in Los Angeles. I thank you so much for joining us from Mexico City, where Tim Johnson, of course, is the bureau chief for McClatchy Newspapers. He's also the author of Tragedy in Crimson, How the Dalai Lama Conquered the World but Lost the Battle with China. Just in closing, though, the Dalai Lama, of course, now basically has quit, right?
Well, he's done a very interesting tactical maneuver. He's declared that he will end his political role as a leader of the Tibetans and really only be a spiritual leader. And I say it's tactical because the Dalai Lama, of course, has always been pressing Tibetans to empower themselves to make decisions, whereas the Tibetans have been very reluctant they've always wanted the Dalai Lama, His Holiness, to make the decisions for them. And so, as he's in the twilight of his life, he is trying to help usher in an era in which they will do more of their own decision-making. They will embrace democracy, have a political leader that they've elected, which they've done, by the way. They've elected a new prime minister. And so I think it's really a symbolic move. He, of course, continues worldwide travels. He'll be in the U.S. In just a matter of a few weeks again. So he's the most visible figurehead of the Tibetan movement, and that won't change.
Well, Tim Johnson, I thank you so much for joining us here today from Mexico City here on Background Briefing.
You're very welcome, Ian.
And again, I've been speaking with Tim Johnson, Mexico City Bureau Chief for McClatchy Newspapers. Well, let's do a wrap-up on today's program. What did we learn today? Well, we had a young reporter on, Meredith Bagby, who's the publisher of the annual report of the USA. She used to work for CNN. She was, of course, we started the program at the very moment that the Senate, House, and the leader and the president met an hour late in the White House, 8 p.m. East Coast time tonight, in a last-ditch effort to come up with a budget deal. It's worth noting that the budget for this 2011 should have been done back in October, and we, of course, know about all this brinkmanship. But she really did explode the fraudulent nature of much of what the Republican House is putting up there and made the case that this is really about the culture wars, not about fiscal conservatism. And unfortunately, that appears to be the case. And whether or not both sides will be blamed equally, which seems to be the mood of the American people, it's pretty clear which side is, in fact, in this case, being totally fraudulent and obsessive. And it's also worth noting that the Tea Party, the people that we thought were supposedly populists, economic populists, are, in fact, pushing to get rid of the EPA and to disallow it from overseeing air, which, of course, is what the Koch brothers want. They don't want the EPA to be able to regulate global warming and air pollution. And the religious issues, too. Where did that come from? I thought that was the Christian conservatives weren't necessarily the Tea Party, but the Tea Party really is a fraudulent operation, and clearly it's the far-right wing of the Republican Party dressed up in patriotic revolutionary uniforms. Then we talked with a Libyan political scientist and native, and about this puzzlement about what's going on with NATO. As soon as the Americans hand it over to NATO, NATO appears to drop the ball. They bombed a bunch of Libyan rebels. The Libyans obviously are a people's army. They can barely, they're like a bunch of Mad Max fighters. They've got no support at all. And it turned out, which I was really surprised to learn, that Gaddafi is hiring these special forces from Belarus who are running his war, along with mercenaries from Chad. So it's quite possible that you have professional soldiers from other countries fighting, you know, only a handful of them, but they're able to hold or even, in fact, defeat this people's army that is so disorganized and NATO doesn't seem to be able to protect or defend or, in what is obviously going to be the case, get rid of Gaddafi. Otherwise, this whole thing doesn't make any sense and it's going to end up bad for everybody. Then finally, I talked with a reporter, his bureau chief for McClatchy down in Mexico City, about the demonstrations yesterday in Mexico City against President Calderon's failed war on drugs. It's cost the Mexican people about 37,000 lives. He basically said that he's just back from Honduras, and he said that the real issue is that Honduras and Guatemala have become completely captured by the drug lords. And what happened is Plan Colombia moved the drug cartels into Mexico, and then Plan Merida have moved them into Central America. And that this, it looks like the pre-party will come back, the crooks who made a deal with the cartels from the very beginning, and that the people in Mexico are so exhausted by this war, which the demonstrations, by the way, were led by a poet, well-known poet and journalist, whose son was murdered. So it's a very, very dismal situation. And again, it always comes back to the fact that we are the customers for the drugs. The drugs, we're the consumers, it's our problem, and we foist it on the Mexicans, and we'll never fix it unless we rethink this absurd war on drugs. This has been Background Briefing. I'm Ian Masters. I'd like to thank producers Spencer Downing and Kim Nassiter. This program is available at ianmasters.com, along with my new blog at ianmasters.com. Bye for now.